Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover.
Well, my next guest today is a broadcaster, historian and a former British cabinet minister. Since he left Westminster in 2005, Michael Portillo has turned his focus to television. And in recent years, when not taking great British railway journeys, Michael's been researching the Irish revolutionary period and the creation of both Northern Ireland and the Irish Free State. His latest documentary, Partition 1921, will be broadcast on RT1 television tomorrow night at 9:30. And I'm delighted to say that Michael joins me now on the line from London. Morning, Michael. Really lovely to speak with you again.
Good morning, Miriam. A great pleasure for me.
Listen, can I start with a question that is central to your film? In Britain, for centuries now, the political class has spoken about the Irish question. What is or was that question?
Yes, and very often we spoke about the Irish problem. Well, the question was that a very large number of people in the island of Ireland were not happy with British rule and wanted to manage their own affairs under Home Rule. And Home Rule was a cause that gained quite a lot of traction in Britain. But there were many in Ireland, at first many in the south and later mainly in the north, who were unionists, who believed that the union of Great Britain and Ireland, that United Kingdom should be preserved without Home Rule. And these issues began to reach their political climax towards the end of the 19th century, not least when William Ewart Gladstone, the Liberal Party Prime Minister, decided that he would try Home Rule. And he had two goes at it, two Home Rule bills, but they were defeated in Parliament. And then they came to an even hotter climax just before the Great War, when the Liberal government, no longer with Gladstone, he was dead by then, but the Liberal government needed the support of the Irish National Party in Parliament. And the price for that was another Home Rule bill. And that was part of the problem, because their Conservative opposition believed that they had only espoused Home Rule for a third attempt because they were desperate to cling to power. And the Conservatives thought that that was extraordinarily cynical and risked not only what would happen in Ireland, but risked the British Empire. Because if Ireland was going to become semi-detached, what could you say to places like India that also had national aspirations?
And at what point did the possibility of partition of this island arise in efforts, I suppose, to answer that Irish question?
That is a very good question. It arises, of course, gradually, as most of these things do. So in the film, I mention Lord Randolph Churchill, who was Winston Churchill's father. Now, Lord Randolph Churchill, all the way back in the 1880s, at the time of the first Home Rule Bill, is talking about Ulster will fight and Ulster will be right. So I suppose there's already an implication that, you know, Ulster is going to be treated differently in some way from the rest of the island. And to me, very remarkably, all the way back in the 1880s, there's this idea that Northern Ireland, to give it that broad name, may actually engage in a civil war or in military activity to avoid being sucked into being part of an island which enjoys home rule under a parliament in Dublin, in which there will be a Catholic and nationalist majority. But the government of Great Britain and Ireland at the time really resists the idea of partition until after the end of the First World War. Before the Great War, the Ulster Volunteer Force has made it very clear that it is well-armed and well-prepared, and it will fight against being included in Home Rule. During the First World War, people in the Republic will think of 1916 as the year of the Easter Rising. In Ulster, 1916 is also thought of as the year of the Battle of the Somme. The UVF have enlisted in the British forces and they have become the 36th Ulster Division, which fights with great distinction in the Battle of the Somme with enormous casualties nonetheless. So by the end of the Great War, it's kind of quite broadly accepted in the British establishment, in the British government, that Northern Ireland is going to have to be excluded from home rule.
Having made this documentary, which I've seen and it's superb, I really enjoyed it. Are you ready to point to a single character, Michael, or event or circumstance that maybe made partition an inevitability in 21?
In a way, I would say the inevitability arises before the Great War. And I make an allusion to that in the programme. I'm standing outside the British Parliament and I say the votes that created Northern Ireland were taken inside this building. But the policy had been coerced by the Ulster Volunteer Force. The British government, which before the Great War was a Liberal Party government in coalition with the Irish National Party, did not want to face up to the fact that if it was going to carry Home Rule through, then there was going to be a civil war. And that appalling prospect at that time was averted, or at least postponed, by the arrival of the Great War. So I suppose it is the activities before the Great War, the raising of the UVF and its arming, that is probably the most significant factor.
I was conscious watching you, Michael, in the documentary. I mean, growing up in England, you're the son of Scottish and Spanish parents. I mean, how did you view the Irish question and the ongoing conflict in Northern Ireland? I mean, to what extent, if any, were you aware of it?
Well, I was certainly aware of it because my teenage years coincided with the beginning of the Troubles. And then I suppose I've been through various stages. I was elected to Parliament in 1984 because my predecessor, Tony Berry, was the only member of Parliament who was killed in the bombing of the Grand Hotel in Brighton. I heard the explosion that had killed Airy Neave. I was a very good friend of Ian Gow. So, you know, many of my experiences of it are to do with loss, actually.
And what impact did those experiences then have on you? And how did that make you maybe think about Ireland?
Well, as I say, I came into Parliament as a result of IRA violence, and that's bound to affect you. But during the 1990s, I became Defence Secretary, and I was on the committee which helped to make a policy known as the NI Committee, for obvious reasons. And the NI Committee, under John Major's chairmanship between 1995 and 1997, agreed to enter negotiations with the IRA. And so I was a party to that decision, and I very much approved of that decision. So, you know, as we like to say in television, I went through a journey.
And I suppose you've spoken in the past about an ignorance of Ireland and its history among many British people. I mean, you were impacted by the loss of people you knew and respected and cared for. But do you think that ignorance remains among British people? Has it worsened in recent times, or is it much the same?
I think it's absolutely a fact and a factor. And I don't think it's changed very much. I think it's been pretty constant. And I've even been struck, you know, talking to people who were involved in the Good Friday Agreement negotiations, that they knew very little about the history. I think I personally knew a little bit more about the history because I'd read history at university. But even so, I'm quite surprised the extent to which history didn't impact upon us. For example, having made these programmes recently, this is the third set of programmes I've been involved in with RTE, I'm now very struck that even though the Conservatives were so adamantly against Home Rule before the Great War, in a pretty short period of time after the Great War, the Conservatives agree to a new political status for the South. The South gets a new constitutional basis. Now, that happened after only 2 years of the War of Independence. And it's striking to me that, on the other hand, you know, the Troubles went on for 30 years. So despite the fact that we could see how conflicts tended to end, that is to say, they tend to end in negotiation. And nonetheless, that perception didn't seem to make much difference to us during the 30 years that the Troubles went on.
And has making these films, Michael, travelling around Ireland, changed your view on this country and our history or not?
I'm constantly amazed by the generosity and the welcome that I'm given by the Irish people. I began making the last set of films by going to Solo Headbeck, where the first shots in the War of Independence were fired. And they were fired against two policemen who were actually both Catholic and Irish. One of them was an Irish speaker. And I was rather shocked when I got there, not find any tribute to these two policemen who'd been killed, but rather, you know, it says here were fired the first glorious shots of the War of Independence. And while I was there, and I was standing there entirely alone in the middle of nowhere at this monument, a car drew up, and it was evident that it had four men in it, and they came to pay their tribute to the monument. And I started walking away because I wasn't feeling all that comfortable, not least as a former defense secretary of the United Kingdom. And I heard, to my horror, the car turn around. It did a U-turn. It pulled up beside me. The window came down. Somebody said, "Are you Michael Portillo?" And I said, "Yes," in a little voice, because by now I was quite frightened. And the man said, "I just love your railway programs. Love your railway programs." Aww. So there I was thinking I was about to get a bullet. And actually, I was just being given this very warm welcome. So I've been surprised by things like that.
And the more you've made these programs, do you come round more to the belief that Britain does have serious questions to answer about its historical and political approach to Ireland, and especially to the North in particular?
Well, yes, I think that that is true. I think also one, you know, has to be sensitive to, you know, history, by which I mean that, you know, people saw things differently then. I suppose one of the things that, you know, keeps striking me, and I've alluded to this, is that dialogue can make such a difference. And dialogue is such a rare commodity. Coming right up to date, on both sides of the divide in the island of Ireland, there are people who legitimately feel that the British government does things to and about Ireland without being in any way conscious of the impact upon the island. So Britain obviously has its own, you know, political agenda, its own political difficulties, the most recent of which is Brexit. I mean, I was a supporter of Brexit, but I think people in both the Republic and in Northern Ireland at the moment feel, you know, my goodness, Brexit was done for very understandable British political reasons, but none of those took account of what the impact would be on Ireland. And I was struck, by the way, that, you know, when the border is created 100 years ago, and because Northern Ireland is going to remain part of the United Kingdom, it doesn't remain part of the United Kingdom like Sussex or Gloucestershire. It has its own parliament, which is a unique arrangement within the United Kingdom at that time. And why so? Because the unionists didn't trust the British government either.
And interestingly, can I get your take on the clashes that are happening just this week, the tit for tat over the protocol, and also Joe Biden's intervention?
Yeah, no, I'm very happy to talk about that. And here, perhaps I revert more to British type. Whilst I'm willing to admit that the British have done things without much regard to their impact in Ireland, I think it would be naive not to recognise that the European Union sees the border situation as an opportunity to try to undo, effectively, Brexit. So if, by one means or another, the United Kingdom can be kept more or less within the single market, which is what the Biden initiative is about, it's saying, why don't you accept the standards of the European Union, then you won't have a problem. Well, you won't have that problem, but you'll have a different problem, which is that Britain, you know, voted to leave the European Union, and the government thinks that that means also leaving the customs union and the single market. So, you know, I think actually Biden has been pretty partisan. He's taken an EU view of this. You know, it isn't just the British who have used and abused Ireland. I think at the moment, the European Union is using and abusing Ireland as a way to try and oblige the British effectively to take back a very important element of what they think they've achieved in Brexit.
I mean, do you think the EU would throw Ireland under a bus?
Well, I think I better leave that to Irish people to decide.
Interestingly, in your documentary, Bertie Ahern, our former Taoiseach, talks about a new and agreed Ireland, not a united Ireland. But post-Brexit, that conversation has come really central here on this island. Do you think that might happen? And what might an agreed Ireland look like?
Well, of course, things can change because that is envisaged by the Good Friday Agreement. So the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, which was permanent under the Government of Ireland Act of 1920, had changed at the time of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 to being contingent upon referendums that could be held north and south of the border at a time when it appeared that opinion might have changed. So you can see the possibility of there being a referendum. And you can see the possibility of a referendum in the north approving moving to a united Ireland. What has me, I must say, in a certain amount of terror is that they would be voting with no idea as to what that united Ireland or new Ireland or whatever you want to call it might be like. And the big issue, it seems to me, that arises from my study, and if I may say your study, because I've seen your program on this as well, is what are the rights of minorities? The issue of minority rights in Northern Ireland is what led to the Troubles. The issue of minority rights in a united Ireland under Home Rule was what led the Unionists to be prepared to do military revolt. And the question of what would be minority rights in Northern Ireland if there were a united Ireland, that is a question, but that's completely unaddressed. Nobody knows what those protections would be. And so my fear is you could have a referendum at a time when none of those important questions have been addressed, and such a referendum would be, to put it mildly, highly destabilizing in those circumstances.
Bertie Ahern, I note in your documentary, Michael, he also offered an epitaph for the border on this island, which one might say reflects the wishful thinking of many nationalists north and south. Can you recall what he said?
Yes, I'd invite him to imagine that he was at the funeral of the border, and what would he say? And I think he said, I would wish that it had never existed. So it was his way of saying that if he were at the funeral, it would be certainly good riddance from his point of view.
I was conscious as well, you've a very interesting interview in the doc with Gerry Adams, and you spoke in the beginning of our interview about the loss of people you greatly respected and admired and cared for. Did you feel any anger towards him when you were talking to him?
Oh, no. I don't think I felt anger. I felt awkwardness, and I think awkwardness is well visible within the interview. I mean, times have moved on, you know, so much. If, you know, if Her Majesty the Queen has shaken hands with people that were, you know, formerly regarded as terrorists, it's, you know, it's not for me to, as it were, to make a fuss. But I will say that I enjoyed the interview with Gerry Adams. And, you know, the fact that he and I could sit down and talk for half an hour or 40 minutes, the fact that we could do that, you know, is in its way marvellous. And we both reflect on the importance of dialogue. You know, he says to me, what was your attitude? Would you have been different if you knew when you were a minister everything that you know now? I probably would have been different. But I do remind him that I entered Parliament because my predecessor had been killed by the IRA. And, you know, he kind of acknowledges that at the time. I think it's quite an interesting moment, if I may say so. And by the way, since I am a politician, I'm not saying that people who have passions and people who feel strongly about things are to be condemned. They're not. Although I'm not a man of violence, I'm strongly of the belief, as my father was, a Spanish Republican, that the great issues between us should be decided by dialogue and by democracy and not by the bullet and the bomb.
Well, look, Michael Portillo, it's a great documentary made by Midas Productions and yourself. Thanks so much for your time today. Partition 1921. It's going to be on RT1 television tomorrow night, right after the 9 o'clock news. Thanks for talking to us today, Michael.
Thank you, Miriam. Thank you so much.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Text us too to 51551. We'd love to hear from you. Lots of reaction to Michael Portillo. Great interview, says John and Grace Stones. Michael Portillo has given us some of the finest television in recent years, and I hope there's much more to come. Patrick Ryan and Loud says, Mary, Michael Portillo's analysis of the EU vis-a-vis Ireland is spot on. Michael O'Regan says, Michael interviewed by Miriam has come a long way from the young Tory fogey of other times. Perhaps we misjudged him. And Noel says, Miriam, I'm a fan of Michael when it comes to his entertaining and fascinating documentaries on great train journeys, etc. However, when it comes to a documentary about the struggle for Irish independence, how can a person who's steeped in the British Conservative Party tradition realistically be able to give a balanced, unbiased judgment? I can't honestly imagine RT showing a documentary about the subject created by an ex-Sinn Féin member.